And welcome back to Coast to Coast. We will take your phone calls this hour with Jonathan Emord as we talk about the opioid epidemic. And he's got the guts to talk about it, and we've got the guts to talk about it with him. And welcome back to Coast, Jonathan Emord with us, the attorney. Jonathan, this verdict, of course, in Oklahoma, was it a jury or just the judge?
Just the judge. And it's really, if you read that decision, I commend it to people. It's very well done. He methodically goes through an enormous quantity of evidence. They had dozens of witnesses, hundreds of exhibits. That were just damning against the pharmaceutical industry, and particularly Johnson & Johnson and Purdue Pharma. The Johnson & Johnson subsidiary, Noramco, is the one it has really a lock on opioid distribution to all the other drug companies. So they were just, you know, intimately involved in this whole promotion scam, and the consequences, really, the blood is on all of their hands. This is horrible.
And also today, California vaccine bills were signed by the governor. There were protests and arrests at the Capitol. Can you tell us a little bit about this?
Well, Governor Newsom went back and forth and back and forth on this. And he appears to have been affected by those protests, but nonetheless, he's bent over backwards to support the bill in the end by allowing its principal features to remain in place. So a physician who provides five or more medical exemptions from California's mandatory vaccination bill will now come under greater scrutiny in 2020 and on by public health authorities in California. And this is really the brainchild of Senator Richard Pan, who essentially wants no exemptions at all. And by elevating the scrutiny of physicians on the sole remaining exemption, he will largely achieve that objective. This is an old regulatory technique that you intimidate the practitioner by putting them under scrutiny. No doctor wants to be under scrutiny for giving out exemptions and have the potential of loss of their medical license. So, they're not going to, but largely this is going to close down the medical exemption in California.
In California. And when, therefore, the rights of the parents to decide if they want their kids vaccinated or not, it's not going to happen, is it?
Right. You end up with, if you really don't want to have your child vaccinated, you're either going to have to homeschool your child or vote with your feet and leave the state. California has become the most draconian of all the states in the union on this issue, and there's no tolerance whatsoever for dissent, despite the absence of really any effective scientific evidence that these people who are getting these exemptions, which represent just a small fraction of a percent of the people in the state, children in the state, they're being persecuted. They already have achieved 95% vaccination immunization rates in California, and that was said by Pan originally to be the herd immunity level. Yet they're not satisfied with that. They want to drive out of existence. They want to punish the small percentage, less than 1%, of families with kids in California who are availing themselves of the medical exemption.
Let's take some calls. Kathy in Allen Park, Michigan, welcome to the program. Hi, Kath.
Hi, George. I'm a first-time caller. I'm very nervous. I have two questions.
Okay. By the way, I used to live in Taylor, Michigan. I bought my first house there when I was 21 years old.
Oh, yeah, I've heard you talk about that on the radio.
Right there. But, yeah, go ahead.
The first question is, what does he think about the law in Michigan that grants immunity to pharmaceutical companies by not allowing Michigan residents to sue Big Pharma if they or a loved one is harmed or killed by a drug that was approved by the FDA?
Let's do that one first, John. Go ahead.
Well, that sort of thing is ridiculous because, of course, whenever you deny people a right to protect themselves against injury through the use of the courts, you're taking away a fundamental right that has been with us since we inherited those common law rights from England. That's an outrage. No state should deny its citizens the right to sue a pharmaceutical company. You know, the federal government did that in the case of vaccines, George.
Yeah, yes, they did. They protected them.
Yeah, and that's there's just so much corruption here with government actors and big pharma. They created the monopolies. You know, these are government-created monopolies through the very system of drug approvals in the United States. They're shielded from competition. They don't even have to police their own markets. The FDA does that for them. It really is a classic example of what the administrative state has done to destroy individual liberty in this country.
Back for your second question, Kath. Go ahead.
Okay, I just want to say we are the only state in the country that has that law or anything like it. Okay, the second question was, what does he think about former FDA employees going to work for drug companies that they once oversaw when they worked for the FDA? Now, does the FDA or government think that those former employees couldn't have been bought by Big Pharma while they were employed by the FDA, you know, with promise of a higher paying job?
Yeah, maybe. Jonathan, you touched on that a little bit earlier.
Right, with Dr. Curtis Wright on the Purdue Pharma OxyContin. Yeah, this is gross. I mean, this is an example of government corruption. It shows you just how in bed together these drug companies and their supposed regulators are. If you know when you're regulating a drug company's product that you have a prospect of employment with that company, do you not think that that's going to alter your sense of how to deal with it? We know over and over again from whistleblowers going to Capitol Hill that time and again FDA has become the mere patsy of the drug industry and has ignored adverse medical information in the drug approval process. This system is so corrupt, in fact, at the FDA that I think the best solution is to, by statute, eliminate the FDA and instead have a drug approval process that's blinded, done at universities that are equipped to do independent testing. A lot of people don't realize this to determine safety and efficacy of the drugs. A lot of people don't realize this. FDA does no testing whatsoever of the drugs that it approves. It relies entirely on the drug companies themselves.
To provide surveys and studies, right?
Sure. And so you've got a conflict of interest that's inherent there. Everyone winks and nods and overlooks any safety issue because the drug industry, if the drug industry doesn't present the safety issue it has with drugs to the FDA assumes that there is no safety issue. When the drug industry presents a application for approval, they've done their own testing. They've selected the test to present. FDA frequently does very little in assessing independently the drugs. In fact, as I said, they do no independent testing, and they rely on the content of the application alone to be sufficient unless they have a specific and profound bit of evidence to suggest otherwise. And even in those instances, even in instances where there's no proven efficacy, the FDA commissioner frequently overrules the medical reviewers and approves the drug anyway.
All right, Kathy, thanks, and you did a great job. No need to be nervous next time. Let's go to first-time caller Lloyd in Maine. Welcome to the show. Hi, Lloyd. Go ahead, sir.
Hi, George. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure thing.
I just wanted to touch on a couple things. I've been taking hydrocodone 10-325 for about 9 years now.
Are you addicted, do you think?
But it's, in my opinion, of all of them, I think that the Vicodin, which is basically that, is what that is. It's 10 milligram Vicodin. I think it's far less addictive than the oxycodone and OxyContin and the others.
Well, the important thing too, Lloyd, is just to restrict yourself to the minimum that you use. So don't pile it on. I have
absolutely.
A friend of mine piled it on, and he's not here anymore.
Yeah. I had a friend that turned to heroin because the doctors cut him off, and that's what I really wanted to mention was having been in this system for so long, I really see that the doctors are really the ones to blame, not so much the pharmaceutical industry as it is the doctors. Because when, you know, right from the get-go, I felt like I was being treated like a criminal. And, you know, if by the end of each month, because I'm in pain management for my rheumatoid arthritis and fibromyalgia, if, you know, at the end of the month, if I was running low on my prescription or what ran out, you know, it became, I was afraid to tell them, because they would immediately want to jump the gun and push a stronger drug, when really what's needed, I think, is, you know, therapy, you know,
And to somehow try to wean you off this. As you know, you can't stop cold turkey. That's just as bad.
Right. And what they end up doing is just cutting people off and letting them go. And the only, you know, whether it's the addiction or the pain or both, the only place they have to turn is to the street.
The street.
And heroin, and that's it.
How much is your prescriptions a month cost you?
It depends what I go through, but if it were the top amount, it's probably about $140
a month.
Yep.
Yeah, and for a lot of people, that's a lot of money. Lloyd, thank you for sharing that with us and having the guts to tell us about it. It's not easy, John.
No, it isn't. And you know, Vicodin is a combination of hydrocodone and acetaminophen, it is a dangerous drug. And unfortunately, when you have unremitting pain like your caller has, you've got to get relief from that pain. But what needs to be explored in every case is the alternatives to the opioids. So weaning people from opioids, keeping the dose low, weaning people from opioids in instances where it is possible to use other options, those other options ought to be applied and used. But it requires a very conscientious physician who's willing to devote the energy to research and then also apply these strategies. And it requires a willingness to do that on the part of the patient, of course. One good bit of information, I mean, this is where the federal government, I think, is getting it right. In 2017, April, HHS Secretary Alex Azar adopted a 5-point strategy to combat the opioid crisis, and then just recently the president has financed a large amount of it. In 2017, he's financed more, where they focus, among other things, on treatment options and give huge amounts of money, $9 billion, to the states to focus on prevention, treatment, and recovery services. So there is hope here. There's money in the pipeline for this. A lot of the drug companies that were a part of this whole racket have tried to save their reputations by developing alternatives and by also focusing on expansion of drugs that are designed to treat overdose and save people from overdose.
John, the people who are on the opioids, where's the pain generally? What are they taking the pills for? Is it like a, you know, sore hip, you know, sore back? What is it?
Well, with the expansion previously for moderate pain and severe pain, yes, you'd have people who would go in, you know, with a temporary condition that might cause a feeling of severe pain, but would be known to be something that would be ameliorated in the ordinary course, and they would be given opioids, and they would become addicted to the opioids. But in the caller's case, this sounds like unremitting pain. I don't know. I'm not a physician, but it sounds like he's got chronic pain, and he's trying to cope with that pain.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a rough situation, where, you know, invariably, depending upon the level of pain, you're going to resort to opioids if you're a physician. But the fact of the matter is that you don't have to in many instances. And in those instances where you do, you've really got to exercise a high degree of interaction and control over the treatment plan and try wherever possible to minimize the opioids and to use options that are other than opioid treatment, such as non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. But, you know, even those drugs have risks, of course. But it takes a very conscientious physician. Unfortunately, we live in an environment where physicians are frequently just prescribing medications, and that has become the norm. And a lot of them don't either have the time or interest, unfortunately, in devoting the time to the specific needs of patients who are always saying, you know, when they're in chronic conditions, they're telling the doctor the truth that I'm in pain. And doctors sometimes are tone deaf to that because they hear it so frequently. But that cannot be that. You know, we've got to have a reorientation of the entire medical community because of years of thinking that a single pill prescription of an opioid is all I need to do.
It's 26 minutes after the hour. We're with Jonathan Emord, the attorney, talking about the opioid crisis. Let us go to Brian in Crestline, California. Welcome to the show. Hi, Brian. Go ahead.
Thanks, George. Hey, good evening to you and Jonathan. Just real quick, I've spoken with you a few times. I worked on your show, The Unexplained, out there in Burbank.
Oh, yeah, the sci-fi show. That's right. You did a great job for us.
Well, thank you. Hey, I was the jib cam giving you the flying shots.
That's right.
I relished the time in between shoots, just sitting there getting to talk with you. It was quite an opportunity to speak with someone not only so nice and humble, but having the knowledge you have of various things. You're a high IQ guy, as well as your guest Jonathan. So not only both of you guys have guts to bring this topic out, you both have high IQ, and also being an uncle who lost a young nephew last year to this problem, I just wanted to run something past both of you gentlemen. I'd like to hear both of your opinions because of this. In a nutshell, in a bigger picture, you have both pretty much laid out a situation where we have the fox running the hen house with the FDA, and I might add the USDA. Both those agencies, well, what do? One promotes, Department of Agriculture, and one of them promotes drugs. What do you think of the idea of someone like our current president or this administration breaking out the big double-sided axe, chopping these agencies down, and placing the auspices of hazardous drugs and foods that cause health problems? Take them away from these agencies and put them under the auspices of something like the Centers for Disease Control.
So, yeah, he's right, John. Something needs to be done to strengthen these agencies or cripple them and spread out their responsibilities.
Yeah, I think we forgot a lesson that was taught to us in the founding of this country, that when government is given power, there's an inherent risk of corruption. And therefore, the founding fathers sought and enumerated powers, environment for under the Constitution, and felt it necessary to add a Bill of Rights in order to protect against the overreach that was anticipated nonetheless. So the point here is a good one. You've got an administrative state which is largely unaccountable to the courts, the Congress, the American people, that is a captive of industry and is, in this case, so clearly a captive of industry. And, yes, I think he's right.
Well, there's too much of a conflict there, too, Jonathan. You're right. Let's talk more about this when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with attorney Jonathan Emord, as we talk about the opioid epidemic. Jonathan, back to Brian's question, of course. Should we chop up the USDA and the FDA?
I think definitely in the case of the FDA, we need to replace the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act with a new statute that gives a regime to private universities for evaluation and testing of drugs where they have the facilities to do that, and does it in a blinded way so that the people who are doing the testing are not aware of the sponsor of the drug. I think if we give it to another government agency like CDC, I'm afraid that the same kind of corruption that exists at FDA will exist there as well. That is that these agencies are headed by political people, and those people are answering to Congress, which is heavily influenced by the drug industry. And at the same time, there's this overwhelming temptation with these multi-trillion-dollar entities to be subject to their influence when these politicians know, or even when the career bureaucrats know, that when they leave the agency, that's where they may well end up and can be benefited by helping that industry. The incidence of corruption, of being a patsy for the drug industry, is so overwhelming. There are so many instances of it at FDA that it's a hopeless cause to try to change that by giving the agency more money or by trying to alter its mission in some respect. It's really the only way to do it, I think, and I agree with your caller, is to end the FDA and create a new regime for drug approval in the United States.
Next up, let's go to Wayne in New Jersey. Welcome to the program. Hi, Wayne.
Hi, George. I've been a longtime listener since Art Bell days.
Thank you, sir.
Enjoy the show extremely much. I have been in chronic pain for 4 or 5 years. Tried NSAIDs. None of them worked. Tried Tramadol, so my doctor put me on oxycodone, a 7.5 milligram oxy and 325 acetaminophen. I can't be on NSAIDs because it bothers my stomach too much. Now, the doctor, both the doctor and the insurance company are protecting each other because they have me do a monthly urine test that tells them whether I'm not using them at all and just selling them or whether I'm overusing them.
Hmm.
And I think it keeps, if you're going to shut down the availability of oxycodone, you're going to hurt the people that need it, that really do need it. And I somewhat have to believe that there's a little bit of a joy and clapping behind the scenes by the cannabis industry, because they're going to benefit from cutting down on oxycodone use. And finally, I have to say that what the victims need to have a little bit of personal responsibility. We're not talking about the personal responsibility aspect of the, quote, victims, unquote. Why didn't they take a little more personal responsibility for their usage?
Well, see, you sound, Wayne, that you're in control of this. I'm not even sure you're addicted to it, are you?
Well, after 8 or 9 hours, I start feeling the effects.
You do? And when you say you feel the effects, what happens?
The headaches come, or the pain comes back, the maybe shakiness and anxiety, and various undesirable symptoms.
And do you basically take, what, one pill a day or a couple?
I'm given 120 a month, which is four days, so that means every 4 to 6 hours. Honestly, I could use it every – I could use 5 a day because it starts coming back before the 6 hours expire.
Do you sleep well?
Yes, I do.
What do you think of all this, John?
Well, I'm not a physician, so I can't second-guess his treatment plan, and it sounds as though he is with his physicians, taking good care of himself as best he can. There's no question but that there is a medical need for painkillers. That's not the point here. I think the point that Judge Balkman and everybody else who's been attacking these companies is concerned about is their aggressive promotion beyond medical need to try to get people in a state of addiction, in essence, by virtue of the fact that their promotions were for moderate pain and saying that they're under-prescribed and so on. Before the 1990s, there were virtually no deaths associated with painkillers, yet painkillers were prescribed because they were limited to acute instances, I mean to instances of unremitting, not acute, but unremitting pain frequently associated with cancer. And the problem, as your caller points out, is that even when you're using this for a medical purpose appropriately, you can become addicted to these things, and then it leads inevitably to dire consequences unless you wean yourself from them. And it's a really hard thing. I mean, it's extraordinarily difficult to live with severe pain. And yet you've got this problem where when you take painkillers, you get some relief, and then you have the symptoms of addiction that come along, and then you need to have higher doses to compensate. And that whole horrible situation is as a result essentially of a failure of medicine. We can't eliminate all pain through other means, unfortunately, but through a series of different things, not just opioids, we can reduce pain to hopefully more manageable levels. And the problem with the medical community, I think, is that it itself has become habitually addicted to giving out pain medication without a conscientious regard for all the alternatives.
Well, that's a good point. Let's go to Perry in Lompoc, California. Hi, Perry. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hey, thank you for taking my call, George, and hello, Jonathan. Really good show with you guys tonight.
Thank you.
Your last caller dovetails into what my point is, that it is personal responsibility by the patients and also the doctors as well. I had major surgery in my upper neck. It was a spinal stenosis, and they literally, you know, have to really cut into your neck pretty good to get in there, you know. After the MRIs and everything are taken, they know exactly what they're doing. I was on morphine for about a week and a half.
Wow.
And yeah, I mean, pretty good dosage of it, because it's so painful, you know, George. And So basically, I wound up for about 2 weeks in a rehab facility, and I oxycodone. And basically, I don't know if it's just me, I was able to go on to the non-steroidals, which also is not that good, as Christian Wild told me a couple weeks ago on the phone. You're better off with that turmeric.
Yes,
that he offers.
It's good for inflammation.
Yeah, and you really don't need those non-steroidals. So I would just like the comment of Jonathan there. And, George, you take care of yourself, all right?
All right. Go ahead, John.
Well, this is an example of the options, you know, among several others, that acupuncture is an option, for example, frequently. So, yes, it's important to start broadening our horizons on pain management, and I salute the president for devoting as much as $9 billion in grants to the states for, among other things, this very purpose. There needs to be scientific endeavors to find non-drug means to treat these things. Of course, the most profitable means have been drug means, no small measure because of the way the FDA regulates drugs. But we need to find alternatives, and we'll all go through pain in our lives, most likely.
Well, there's nothing worse than a stiff neck, John.
Oh. And,
you can't bend.
I mean, a lot of people will go in with kidney stones, and that's horrific pain. And the first thing they'll do is be given an opioid, when in many instances they ought to be given an NSAID. Now, your caller's right. You know, if you use NSAIDs, particularly the very potent NSAIDs, you're at risk of complications from that. But again, managed appropriately in the right patient, They can be used as an alternative to opioids in an acute pain situation, like, for example, kidney stones.
Good point. Let's go to
broadening of horizons needs to happen in medicine.
Let's go to Sean in Eatonville, Washington. Welcome to the program, Sean. Go ahead.
Hi, George. I just wanted to say that I've been fighting opiates and the abuse that I put myself through, but I was a skin graft burn victim, and then I also broke my back in three different places.
Oh, my
so,
God.
You know, I've had some tough times with the OxyContin generally. I mean, I was up to like Jonathan said, I was up to about 380s a day.
Jeez.
And that happened. I did probably that for 20 years, and then I finally quit cold turkey. And 8 years ago, and your show's been a godsend to me because the pain is so bad when you're withdrawing that you can't watch TV. You can't, light hurts your eyes. So the radio show was everything to me, and I just.
Well, we're always here for you, and you sound like you came through it pretty good once you got to a certain point.
That's right, and I mean, 4 years into it, it was bad, and now it's 8 years into it. Now I'm better. I still go through 2 weeks of withdrawal where I have the diarrhea and all the other symptoms, the coughing and the sickness. But because my mind was, I was actually on with Lisa Garr and a pain management doctor that she had on.
Yeah.
And he says basically what happens is you got holes in your brain. And
jeez.
For us, you know, the cabal is that they want to sell us methadone and Suboxone. And they're right there ready to sell the remedy. Truthfully, it's the same thing.
Well, I'm glad things are going well for you. Stay strong. It's not easy, Jonathan, to go through this and come out the way he did.
It isn't. He's a tremendous example, I think, for other people who are in a similar situation with addiction. What great courage he had. And, you know, to endure those horrible physical pain associated with being a burn victim, and then also the fractures and so on, that takes a lot of courage in and of itself. And then to go through the addiction and come out on the other side and be in control again of your life away from the drugs. It's not often that you see someone with that degree of courage and strength, personal conviction, and it's commendable, and it's a great example for others.
Jonathan, in the few moments we have, I want you to give folks the best advice you can based on this addiction.
Well, I think there are a large number of people who are on the street who are using opioids and are in this spiral where they're ultimately going to be killing themselves. And they need to understand, and people who are relatives or others or former friends or current friends need to reach out to these people and get them the treatment that they need, the care that they need. More naltrexone, which is used to combat overdose immediately after someone overdoses, needs to be available and is going to be available as a result of the money coming from the Trump administration. Authorities out there, police and fire departments, who need to have this, particularly in the cities that are in the southeast where there's so much abuse going on. And then, you know, to the medical community, let's wake up. Let's take this seriously. I think most doctors are, but we really need to look at alternatives, and that's where the education has to come from. This is a long haul, George. We're going to see this affecting our lives probably for the rest of our lives, if we're lucky, for the next several decades, but it's going to be with us. And the costs of it are going to be with us. And this is going to be a very expensive and very difficult thing for our nation to endure. This is a point of vulnerability, as the Chinese have found in our country by dumping the fentanyl from China into the illicit drug trade.
Well, the biggest thing, John, is for us to talk about it and make people aware of this disaster. Jonathan's website, of course, is emord.com. Up next, we're going to talk about Stranger West, some paranormal things.